Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. It's hard not to dwell on missed connections, on the moments when life goes one way, when it could so easily have gone another, and by the idea that something as small as a lost piece of paper could alter the course of a life. Deborah Kopaykin's essay, When Cupid is a Prying Journalist, is about one of those missed connections. It's read by Susan Kelechi Watson. She stars in the NBC show This Is Us.
My interview with Justin McLeod was winding down when I tossed out one last question. Have you ever been in love? The baby-faced chief executive had designed Hinge, which was a new dating app. My question was an obvious throwaway. Justin looked stricken. No one, he said, had ever asked him that in an interview. Yes, he finally answered, but I didn't realize it until it was too late. Then he asked me to turn off my recorder. I hit stop. Off the record, he looked relieved to unburden himself. Her name was Kate. They were college sweethearts. He kept breaking her heart, tears now swelling in his eyes. He wasn't the best version of himself back then. He had since made amends to everyone, including Kate, but she was now living abroad, engaged to someone else. "Does she still know you love her?" I asked. "No," he said. "She's been engaged for 2 years now." 2 years, I said. Why? I don't know. I was by then a year into a separation from a two-decade marriage. I'd been doing a lot of thinking about the nature of love, its rarity. The reason I was interviewing Justin, in fact, was that his app had helped facilitate a post-separation blind date, my first ever, with an artist for whom I had fallen at first sight. That had never happened to me. The at first sight part. He was also the first man to pop up on my screen after I downloaded Justin's app. For those keeping score at home, those were a lot of firsts. First dating app, first man on my screen, first blind date, first love at first sight. I was interested in understanding the app's algorithm, how it had come about, how it had guessed, by virtue of our shared Facebook friends, that this particular man, a sculptor with a focus on the nexus between libidinal imagery and blossoms, would take root in my heart. "You have to tell her," I said to Justin. "Listen." And I told him the story of the boy I had loved just before meeting my husband. He was a senior in college, studying Shakespeare abroad. I was a 22-year-old war photographer based in Paris. We had met on a beach in the Caribbean. Then I visited him in London, shell-shocked after having covered the end of the Soviet-Afghan War. I thought of him every day I was covering that war, when I was sleeping in caves, so sick from dysentery and an infected shrapnel wound on my hand that I had to be transported out of the Hindu Kush by Doctors Without Borders. My love for him is what kept me going. But a few weeks after my trip to London, he stood me up. He said he would visit me at my apartment in Paris one weekend and never showed. Or so I thought. 2 decades later, I learned he had actually flown to Paris that weekend, but had lost the piece of paper with my address and phone number. I was unlisted. He had no answering machine. We had no friends in common. He wound up staying in a hostel, and I wound up marrying and having 3 children with the next man I dated. And so life goes. By the time Google was invented, the first photo of me to appear on his screen was of my children and me from an article someone had written about my first book, a memoir of my years as a war photographer. Soon after, he married and had three children with the next woman he dated. And so life goes. I found him by accident, doing research on theater companies for my last novel. There he was above his too common name. I composed the email, "Are you the same man who stood me up in Paris?" That's how I learned what happened that weekend and began to digest the full impact of our misconnection. His work brought him to New York a few months later, and we met for a springtime lunch on a bench in Central Park. I was so flummoxed, I kicked over my lemonade and dropped my egg salad sandwich. Our long-lost love was still there. In fact, the closure provided by our reunion and the shock of recognition of a still extant love that had been deprived of sun and water would thereafter affect both of our marriages, albeit in different ways. He realized how much he needed to work on tending to his marriage. I realized I had given mine all the nutrients and care I could. 23 years of tilling that soil, but the field was fallow. Hearing of Justin's love for Kate while seated on another New York City bench 4 years later, I felt a fresh urgency. "If you still love her," I told him, "and she's not married yet, you have to tell her. Now. You don't want to wake up in 20 years and regret your silence. But you can't do it by email or Facebook. You actually have to show up in person and be willing to have the door slammed in your face." He laughed wistfully. "I can't do that. It's too late." 3 months later, he emailed me an invitation to lunch. The article I wrote about him and his company, in which he had allowed me to mention Kate, whom I had called Rosebud, had generated interest in his app, and he wanted to thank me. On the appointed day, I showed up at the restaurant and found the hostess. "Justin McLeod, table for two," I said. "No," he said suddenly behind me, "for three." "Three? Who's joining us?" "She is," he said, pointing to a wisp of a woman rushing past the restaurant's window, a blur of pink coat, her strawberry blonde hair trailing behind her. "What the? Is that Rosebud?" "Yes." Kate burst in and embraced me in a hug. Up close, she resembled another Kate, Hepburn, who had appeared in the comedies of remarriage I had studied in college. These films, precursors to today's rom-coms, were made in America in the 1930s and 40s, when showing adultery or illicit sex wasn't allowed. To pass the censors, the plots were the same. A married couple, divorced, flirted with others, then remarried. The lesson? Sometimes you have to lose love to refind it. And a return to the green world is the key to reblossoming. "This is all because of you," Kate said, crying. "Thank you." Now Justin and I were tearing up too, to the point where the other diners were staring at us, confused. After we sat down, they told me the story of their reunion, finishing each other's sentences as if they had been married for years. One day, after a chance run-in with a friend of Kate's, Justin texted Kate to arrange a phone conversation, then booked a transatlantic flight to see her without warning. He called her from his hotel room, asked if he could stop by. She was to be married in a month, but 3 days later, she moved out of the apartment she had been sharing with her fiancé. I felt a pang of guilt. Poor man. It was okay, she said. Their relationship had been troubled for years. She had been trying to figure out a way to postpone or cancel the wedding, but the invitations had already been sent, the hall and caterer booked, and she didn't know how to resolve her ambivalence without disappointing everyone. Justin had arrived at her door at nearly the last moment he could have spoken up or forever held his peace. By the time of our lunch, the two were already living together. Soon afterwards, I had them over for dinner to introduce them to the blossom-obsessed artist who bore half of the responsibility for their reunion. He and I hadn't worked out as a couple, much to my pain and chagrin. But we had found our way back into a close friendship and even an artistic collaboration after he texted me a doodle he'd been drawing. In fact, We had just signed the contract to produce three books together, The ABCs of Adulthood, The ABCs of Parenthood, and, oh, the irony, The ABCs of Love. "What was the doodle?" Kate asked. I showed her the drawing on my iPhone. "Are those ovaries?" she asked, smiling. "Or seeds," I said. "Or flower buds, depending on how you look at it. All perfectly reasonable interpretations of love begetting love begetting love, which is why we were all gathered around my table that night, weren't we? Because real love, once blossomed, never disappears. It may get lost with a piece of paper, or transform into art, books, or children, or trigger another couple's union while failing to cement your own. But it's always there, lying in wait for a ray of sun, pushing through thawing soil, insisting upon its rightful existence in our hearts and on earth.
That's Susan Kelechi Watson reading Deborah Kopaykin's essay, When Cupid is a Prying Journalist. Deborah's story is the basis of episode 2 of the Amazon Modern Love Show, starring Catherine Keener. There's more to Deborah's story after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
So Deborah Kopaykin brought Justin and Kate back together. But we asked her what happened to them afterward.
The couple doesn't just saunter off into the sunset, right? They have to figure out who they are. I mean, this was a couple that were a couple in college, and suddenly they're in their late 20s. And yes, the love is still there, but who are they as adults? What do they want together as a couple? There were a lot of questions I think both of them had. So they had planned a wedding, and Justin called off the wedding, much to Kate's consternation.
But that wasn't the end of their story.
There was a lot of back and forth and a lot of trying to get to the point where they knew what this love was, how they wanted to define it, how they wanted to define themselves. So they did a lot of work, and they decided to elope with 5 people present, the 2 of them, an officiant who they found, and a photographer. And so I was basically the only guest. They did it in their living room of their apartment in Williamsburg. It was the most beautiful wedding I have ever witnessed, just because of what I know they went through to get to that moment.
Kate and Justin are still married, and Kate just had a baby.
They called me an hour later, and I rushed over there because I now live in their neighborhood, and I got to see little Ollie at about, 23 hours old. I can't describe how special this young couple is for me. It's the hope, and it's the life expression of the love that I didn't get to live.
Deborah brought us back to the moment when she met the lover she lost in Paris in her early 20s.
I really thought at the end of the 10 days, that's it. This is the guy. This is the one I love. I mean, this is what do I need more in this world than this love? He's just wonderful. He's smart. He's funny. He's beautiful. We're attracted to one another, blah, blah, blah. So then I get back to Paris, and the plan was that he was going to visit me in 2 weekends. And Friday rolls around, and I'm really excited. And we'd spoken that morning, and I knew that he was going to leave. Friday night rolls around, and I'm wondering where he is because he said he'd be coming in around 4 or 5 o'clock that afternoon. And it's now 6, it's now 7, it's 8, it's 9, it's 10, and I'm a little desperate. So I try calling his number in London, but it was like one of those hallway phones from dormitories way back when where nobody answered. Of course, he was in Paris having lost the piece of paper with my name on it, and so he had gone to stay at a youth hostel because he just didn't know how to call me or where to get to me. And I mean, I just cried the whole weekend. I just thought, wow, I didn't expect this from him. You know, what a disappointment.
Fast forward to when Deborah reconnected with that man during what she calls the free fall of her marriage.
We would talk to each other, and we'd have these really real conversations that I couldn't have with my girlfriends and I couldn't have with my couple friends because they knew my husband. I didn't want to malign him. But with this person that had known me and loved me way back when, there was a safety in that. And there was also this unlived life, right? And so this man became a catalyst for me to understand what I was missing in my relationship, what I was missing in my marriage, and what I needed to do, which was to end the marriage and seek out what I had found way back when in this other relationship.
But those conversations led to something different for him. He and his wife had 3 small children and were going through a rough patch in their marriage.
And I think for him, seeing the real issues I was having, which were unfixable, versus the issues that he and his wife were having, which were just normal and fixable. And when he would talk about her, I could tell he loved her. And I would point this out. I would say, yeah, it's hard, but look at the way you talk about her. You love this woman. And I think for him, it was eye-opening in terms of, oh, yeah, I do. I love my family. I love my daughters. I love this little unit we've created, and I can't wait to get back to it.
Deborah isn't in close touch with him anymore, and we asked her, does she ever think about that unlived life, the life she might have had with him?
You know, the unlived life, to try to live it in the present day, when there's a family involved. I mean, I wasn't going to stand between him and his beautiful kids and his beautiful wife. That was not going to happen. And I kind of thought to myself, of course I fantasize about it. Of course, right? What would it have been like? What would it be like? But you can't do that to somebody else's love story. You just can't. So, you know, the unlived life, instead of being sad about it, it teaches us. So for me, that unlived life with him taught me about what I was not getting in my current life that I absolutely a priori needed to move forward in life.
Deborah did move forward. In 2017, she met her partner, Will, who she's been with ever since.
Now I look at that lost love back in 1989 as the thing that led me to Will. I mean, had I not lost that love, I wouldn't have married the man I married. Had I not married that man, I would have not had the wonderful kids I had. Had I not had a shitty marriage, I would have not gotten divorced. And had I not gotten divorced, I would not have gone on Bumble that day that Will happened to have a photo up there and met him. And so, you know, one event, as in all of our lives, led to the other, and I feel just grateful to be with Will right now. So it's bittersweet insofar as the love from back in 1989 didn't work out. But look what it spawned. Love is the goal. It's not the person. And I know we like to think of, you know, this is the love of my life. In Judaism, I'm a Jew, we have the idea of Bashert, right? I'm 53 right now, and I don't believe in Bashert. I don't believe in the one. I believe that there are many ones out there for all of us. And the key to any love story is to go into it with your heart open for the possibility of what it can be.
That's Deborah Kopaykin. She's a contributing writer to The Atlantic and author of 7 books, including the upcoming memoir, Lady Parts. More after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Daniel Jones is the editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times. He says that he, like a lot of us, is fascinated by stories of missed connections like Deborah's.
She has this accidental missed connection that could only have happened before we had cell phones and before we were in constant touch with each other all the time, where she really felt like the love of her life slipped away because of a lost piece of paper. And she felt like she needed, when she was faced with someone in a similar circumstance, to say, we may not get that many great loves in our life. If you have one, you better go for it. It was just almost sort of a mind-blowing series of events that Deborah pulled together, you know, really perfectly in a 1,500-word essay that I just think leaves such a lasting impression on readers. To be brave, you know, go after what you want and seize it. And if you lose it, then, you know, at least you gave it your best shot. But to not give it your best shot is really the warning she gives Justin. You know, go for it. And if you lose, you lose. But you could win.
And here's Susan Kelechi Watson.
What I loved about this essay was you never know. You never know what really happened until you actually know. You could assume, you know, he just didn't show up. But the reality was he just wasn't able to show up. This man that she had fallen in love with just lost a piece of paper. It was as simple as that. And at the same time, Justin could have thought, you know, Kate was going to move on and her being engaged was the end of it. But him showing up changed that. It makes me think that no matter what, love remains.
Thanks again to Susan for reading this week's piece. She plays Beth on NBC's This Is Us. Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Caitlin O'Keefe. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Special thanks to Julia Simon, Anya Stremian, and Mia Lee at the New York Times. Additional music courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. My other job is hosting an NPR show called On Point. Check it out in your podcast feed. We'll see you next week.